stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Laos, where he will lay the groundwork for a February summit with leaders of 10 ASEAN, or Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Those are countries that will be hosted by President Barack Obama. Kerry arrived in the capital, Vientiane, late Sunday. It's the first leg of a three-nation tour of Asia that also includes stops in Cambodia and China. During his stay, Kerry and Asian leaders will discuss pressing regional issues, including the South China Sea dispute and growing concerns about North Korea's nuclear program. In February, President Obama will host a special ASEAN summit in California. Australia and Thailand are strengthening anti-terror cooperation amid fears of more attacks in the region by groups associated with Islamic State supporters. Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok.
The move by Australia and Thailand to step up security cooperation comes during what Australia's Justice Minister Michael Keenan calls a deteriorating security situation.
We know we've got a big regional challenge. This is a menace that is stalking Indonesia, it's certainly stalking Australia, it's troubling Malaysia, it's troubling the Philippines, and no country in the region is immune from that. Definitely a challenge that we all share together, and that's why that cooperation is vitally important.
Panattan Mataniagorn, an advisor to the Thai Deputy Prime Minister Prawit Wongsawan, says a regional security cooperation structure came into place after the 2002 bombings on the Indonesian resort island of Bali that claimed 200 lives. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Please look at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Iranian officials say the country's flagship airline will finalize a deal to purchase 114 jets from Airbus when President Hassan Rouhani visits France on Wednesday. Iranian media quoted Transport Minister Abbas Akhundi saying Iran Air and Airbus will sign the agreement. Akhundi has not given any specific terms, including the price of the planes. The cost will run billions of dollars, but Iran badly needs the planes to upgrade its fleet of passenger jets, which were subject to years of sanctions and suffered from a lack of maintenance. Millions of people in the eastern United States are digging out their cars and homes on Sunday after two relentless days of snow that will enter the history books as one of the largest snowstorms on record. The snow tapered off overnight around Washington, D.C., where many areas near the Capitol received more than 60 centimeters of snow. Blizzard conditions meant visibility was extremely low on the area's nearly deserted streets for much of Saturday. Further up the coast, the National Weather Service said New York City's Central Park recorded at least 64 centimeters of snow. Authorities there lifted a travel ban early Sunday morning that had limited the movement of the area's 8.4 million residents since Saturday. Syrian forces recaptured the town of Rabia Sunday, continuing their string of victories over rebels in the northwestern province of Latakia. Rabia is about 10 kilometers south of the Turkish border and is one of more than a dozen areas the government said its fighters took control of in recent days. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which monitors violence in Syria, said the pro-government troops were backed by Russian airstrikes and strategic help from Russian military officers. Germany's Interior Minister said Sunday the country is still taking in around 2,000 refugees a day, but it is now denying entry to about 200 others daily at its borders. The tighter border controls come after the EU's top economy last year took in a record 1.1 million refugees and migrants, straining resources and sparking heated political debate. Thomas de Maizière spoke to the newspaper Bild am Sonntag. U.S. President Barack Obama says Pakistan can and must do more against terror groups operating from within its borders. In an interview published Sunday by the Press Trust of India, Obama said Pakistan can show it is serious about dismantling terror networks. Earlier this month, India blamed a Pakistani-based militant group for an attack on an Indian Air Force base. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There was a focus on bilateral relations between Zimbabwe and Equatorial Guinea. You know, we have a far-flung relationship around the economy, around security issues.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe meets Equatorial Guinean leader in Harare to talk about the security situation in Africa.
The promise that President Magufuli has given to Tanzanians that you want to have leaders who are clean, leaders who are ethical, leaders who can perform, and he's fighting against corruption.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli suspends two senior immigration officials following allegations of financial malfeasance.
It brings to the fore the fact that we haven't resolved a major issue with the refinery segment in Nigeria, which is protecting the network of pipelines that supply them crude oil.
And an attack on a gas pipeline in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta region raises fears that a dormant insurgency could be coming back. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe held a meeting with President Teodoro Obiang Nguema in Bazogo of Equatorial Guinea Saturday to discuss the security situation in Africa as well as bolstering bilateral relations between Harare and Malabo. The meeting comes weeks ahead of this year's African Union's Head of State and Government Summit, planned to be held later this month in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. George Charamba, spokesman for Mr. Mugabe, says the Zimbabwean leader has championed the cause of African countries on the international stage as leader of the African Union.
Three key areas were covered. A review of the African security situation, with particular emphasis on hotspots on the continent. And I'm talking about the rise of terrorism as well as instability, which is arising from lack of cohesion within nation states, African nation states. That's one area. And then secondly, a review on Africa's bid for a restructured Security Council and a bid which is based on the as-and-when consensus, which is the African position. That's an area which has to be taken forward by whoever is succeeding from President Mugabe. And then thirdly, there was a focus on bilateral relations between Zimbabwe and Equatorial Guinea. You know, we have a far-flung relationship around the economy, around security issues. So there was that bilateral element. So those were the three areas which were focused on by the two presidents.
People seem to be interested in President Robert Mugabe's leadership. What would you say his leadership has been following his role in leading the continental body, the African Union, in this period?
Generally, we went in with a view to, one, making sure that 2063 takes off a very firm foundation. And then secondly, to make sure that the debate on restructuring the Security Council, which debate was beginning to sag, was beginning to lack that impetus, that oomph that would take Africa forward, is reignited. And I think to that extent, there's been quite a repositioning of African agenda on the United Nations. And that's basically what we want to ensure that you know, there is enough momentum until we get to the desired end. And then thirdly, to really look at the possibility of industrializing Africa so that Africa ceases to be a net exporter of primary commodities and begins to beneficiate value aid on the continent for creation of jobs for its children here on the continent. It's that dependent relationship that Africa has had with the rest of the world, a dependence arising from a failure to self-assert. This is basically, these are the aspects which the president has brought into the leadership question on the continent.
What would you say is the diplomatic relations between Harare and Malabo?
It's a relationship which was founded on an attempt by some mercenaries to subvert that very peaceful and progressive society. You may recall that there was once upon a time with a group of mercenaries led by one man, which was destined to attack the sovereignty of Equatorial Guinea. that world trip came to grief in Harare, thereby preserving, helping Equatorial Guinea preserve its much-needed peace. I mean, you can imagine what could have happened if that terrible campaigner succeeded. So really, it is a relationship that was founded on a security premise. But nations go beyond just security concerns. Of course, that's the, if we were to talk about Maslow, that would be the first law, the first order of needs. But we have now tried to expand that relationship well beyond security concerns. It's about, it has focused on energy, it has focused on skills development, and there are quite a number of Equatorial Guinean youth who are in universities and colleges in Zimbabwe. It has focused on cultural exchange. It recently saw us collaborating in securing the African Games. So really, it's a very rich relationship. And of course, there's also the personal dimension between the two families, a real warm relationship.
The birthday of the president is coming up shortly. Some people are saying because of the poor weather conditions, they are not able to farm and harvest, and that the amount of money that will be used should rather be used to help some of them. What do you make of such assessment and criticism of the birthday bash, which they say is too lavish?
You see, there are two stories I must expect at the beginning of every year. My president must die and then get resurrected by the same press that pronounces him thoroughly dead. It's a story I budget for every year. And the president invariably has to die in January, okay? The second story I must budget for are the gratuitous claims around the so-called birthday bash. Now, in the first place, the state does not contribute a single cent to that due, which is less of a bash and more of a platform for interacting with the youth. The emphasis on food comes from a misperception that has been cultivated by a self-serving media. When you attend those sessions, you discover it's less about eating and more about relaunching the youth meaningfully in such a way that they will play a role in the development process of the country. So really, that money is not coming from government in the first place, assuming there's some food which is being eaten there. And if there is food, to also get you to appreciate that the food comes from the host province. It does not come from the fiscus. So really, there's a false connection which is being claimed here between whatever is expended on food in Masvingo, which is where the meeting is going to take place, and the development prospects of Zimbabwe. I mean, that's a false connection. This is money raised from Zimbabweans who support their president, who appreciate his work, and who also want to commemorate his birthday. But the focus, as I said, is less on the stomach and more on the head.
Joe Charamba is the spokesman for Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Meanwhile, two women who challenged the constitutionality of child marriages in the Constitutional Court in Zimbabwe and won the case are happy that this will ensure that children can now live without fear of being dragged into unwanted marriages. Reporting for VOA, Patricia Mudadigwa caught up with one of the women, Ruvumbo Chopodzi, who was represented by Attorney Tendai Biti.
Chopodzi said she's happy that the Constitutional Court outlawed early child marriages, which had become common in Zimbabwe. Chopodzi, who got married at a tender age and will soon be turning 20, said she hopes the judgment will change the lives of young women in Zimbabwe and protect the girl child by preserving their sexual reproductive health.
About the judgment yesterday, I feel excited because I've been waiting for this moment. Because last year we went to the court and we told them our story, but they were just saying, they were criticizing us because they were saying, these girls, they did it for themselves. Why should they report this to our law, to the court? But I'm glad that they put their heads together and come out with one good law for the young girls, because they know that the law says they should be married at the age of 18.
A Harare resident, Tawanda Sibanda, said it was a shame that the state contested the matter instead of just conceding that anyone under the age of 18 is too young to get married.
This is a welcome judgment, given the fact that it advances the rights of children as defined in the Constitution. However, the there are certain issues which I think are the defendants, being the Minister of Legal and Parliamentary Affairs, who is also charged with aligning the laws to the Constitution. I think he was not supposed to take this matter in the first instance, defending it before the Constitutional Court, on the basis that he is the very person who is charged or mandated to align the laws to the Constitution.
Sibanda further said the government should just align relevant laws to the new Constitution in order to enforce the court ruling.
The defendants should not have defended this matter in the first place. So at the end, what it means is the minister responsible for legal and parliamentary affairs, Minister of Justice, he is not willing, or should we say he does not have the will, be it political or otherwise, to align the laws with the different statutes with the Constitution.
Tsungai Mutongwizo, another Harare resident, also applauded the judgment and said some women were afraid of raising girl children because of forced marriages.
We welcome this as mothers of girls. Zimbabwe was becoming a place that we were scared of raising young children, of raising girls, wondering who would protect them. In terms of the new constitution, this is a giant step for the country, the judicial system, in making rights justiciable, protecting the rights of vulnerable people. Young girls are vulnerable and need the protection of the law. This is equal protection of the law.
The Constitutional Court on Wednesday ruled that no child in Zimbabwe should marry or get married before attaining the age of 18. Reporting for Studio 7 in Harare, this is Patricia Mdadigwa.
Tanzanian President John Magufuli suspended two senior immigration officials following allegations of impropriety and financial malfeasance in a move to ensure accountability in our public institutions. Gerson Nzigwa, the acting director of information at the presidency, says the two officials were suspended at the beginning of an investigation into allegations of corruption, mismanagement, and poor revenue collection. Nsigwa told me new measures the president implemented sharply increased revenue collection from $400 million to more than $600 million, an increase of over 50%.
On the suspensions that have been done so far to several big officials in the government, refers to the promise that President Magufuli has given to Tanzanians that he wants to have leaders who are clean, leaders who are ethical, leaders who can perform, and he is fighting against corruption. And therefore, when it comes to the situation where a certain official in his organization, there are some allegations about corruption, then president is trying to take actions immediately. And some of the big officials that have been suspended so far, there are some investigations that are going on the institutions that they've been leading. And they've been suspended to wait for the results when the investigation will be finished. And therefore, if they'll be found innocent, then the president will decide otherwise.
One of the criticisms being leveled against him is that he's behaving like the traditional soda can, and that he's coming in hot. With time, he's going to cool down and will be ineffective. What is your reaction to such criticisms?
Personally, I don't believe so. President Magufuli has been a minister for construction for a long time. First, he has been in the cabinet for 20 years. And among the 20 years, 15 years served as a minister in the construction ministry. And he has performed wonders. You know, the government, in the past 10 years only, about 17 kilometers of tarmac road have been constructed in this country. This is a very big achievement, and everyone appreciates what has been done by the Minister of Construction and Magufuli. And the man is a performer, always. What he's trying to do this time is just to clear grounds so that he has a good environment to make sure that all the promises that he given to Tanzanians are well implemented. You know, he has promised about jobs, boosting the economy, and many more. Now, you cannot make this happen if you have people who are delaying the process, people who are corrupt, who are unethical, and who are not in the proper discipline of the civil service. This is what President Magufuli is trying to do. And all Tanzanians, we've been receiving a lot of feedbacks that all Tanzanians are happy and they pray for him. And as I'm talking to you, we are in Arusha. He has been traveling from Kilimanjaro International Airport to Arusha town. All the way, people has lined up alongside the road and saying thank you very much to the president, and the president has promised that he will not let them down.
Some people are saying he appears to be too much of in a hurry. Instead of taking his time to ensure a thorough investigation before those who have been proven to be complicit in these allegations are prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and that all what he is doing is just a publicity exercise or a publicity stunt. What do you say to that?
We cannot stop that. Everyone is free to give their opinions. But, you know, what President Magufuli promised the people during the campaign, he made it clear that he wants things to happen now. He doesn't want to see things delaying. He wants things to go quickly. So, you know, his term is just 5 years, the first term. In case he gets another, it will be 10 years. 10 years or 5 years is not a long time. Now, if you spend too much time cleaning the government, removing those people who are corrupt, those people who cannot perform, you spend a lot of time, you will find yourself having very short time to pursue what you have promised the people. You know, you know, according to the policy of the ruling party CCM, is that they've promised that this country now has to go to the medium income country. So. You cannot go to that if you have so many people with the delays in the government.
What do you say about people who said he should boost the morale of the public sector workers, paying them well so that they will be effective and working for the people of Tanzania?
In my opinion, I think so far many public servants are happy and their morale has gone very high. Those who will not be happy are those who have some scandals, are not pursuing their duties accordingly. These people will not be happy because, you know, in America, everyone is accountable to what he is supposed to do. So this is what Magufuli is trying to cultivate in this country. And, you know, there will be some other people who are lazy, maybe those who use it to just swindle some public funds, you know. People like these will not be happy, automatically will not be happy, but I can assure you, these are very few.
Gerson Nsingwa is the acting director of information at the Tanzanian presidency. He spoke with me from Arusha. In South Sudan, a Ministry of Education official says the government will work with aid agencies to reduce the extremely high number of children not attending school in the region. A report released this month by the United Nations Children Agency, UNICEF, says South Sudan is home to the highest proportion of out-of-school children in the world. More than half of primary and low secondary age children are not receiving an education. For VOA Mugumi, Davis Nrakarinja reports from Juba that a lack of funding and insecurity contribute to the educational problems in conflict zones.
Lopuke Lotiam, Undersecretary of the Ministry of Education, says children's education in South Sudan was bad even before the conflict broke out in late 2013. Lotiam says the government is planning to increase the education budget to help rehabilitate schools destroyed by the 2 years of fighting.
There is a commitment of the government to put more funds in education, and also another strategy is to mobilize the communities in terms of local contribution. Because if you think of funding to build a classroom, you need to involve the people. You need to ask the people their contribution, whatever they can.
Only 6% of South Sudan's budget is allocated to education. The Ministry of Education uses much of that money to pay the salaries of officials. The UNICEF report says a severe lack of funding is to blame for the high school dropout rate and the woefully inadequate number of qualified teachers in South Sudan. Lotiam says even before the conflict began, the government was aware of the problem. UNICEF's education officer for South Sudan, Fun Nguyen, says the conflict in Unity, Lakes and Jonglei states has affected many children.
We find that due to the fact that schools were closed, schools were occupied by armed groups, schools were closed because of the lack of operational maintenance and budget, schools were destroyed, destructed, occupied also by not only armed groups but also by IDPs. All of these reasons contributed to the number of children who had to drop out. And of course, poverty.
Win says poverty is a huge problem in South Sudan. Between 2013 and 2015, Win says more than 800 schools were destroyed. Win says the government and other aid agencies must make education a top priority. She says attending school not only prevents children from becoming fighters for various militia groups in the country, but allows them to learn life skills.
Life skills against protection against gender violence, how to wash hands, how to maintain their health, how to avoid mine risk, and so forth. So not only do children have a sense of normalcy when they go to school, but also the fact that the environment itself is protecting them from safety, from harm. So they are much safer in the classroom than not, especially adolescent boys and girls, adolescent boys who may be recruited into armed groups and armed forces.
Lopoke Lotiam says with the help of the United States Agency for International Development, his ministry was able to construct 350 learning centers for 400,000 children across the country. Kenya International, Save the Children, Oxfam and other international agencies are working with the Ministry of Education to give South Sudanese children an opportunity to go back to school after facing years of violence across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
An attack on a gas pipeline in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta region has raised fears that a dormant insurgency could be coming back. For VOA, Chris Stein reports with Hilary Uguru in Ugeli, Nigeria.
The attacks last weekend came shortly after a judge in the commercial capital Lagos issued a warrant for the arrest of former Niger Delta militant, Government Ekpemu Polo, better known by his moniker Tom Polo, who is wanted on charges that include money laundering and conspiracy. A gas pipeline that connected to the major Escravos-Lagos pipeline system was attacked. A pipeline that carried crude oil was also damaged, forcing the Nigeria National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC, to shut down two refineries. Nigeria imports most of its refined products, like gasoline and diesel. President Muhammadu Buhari has made weaning Nigeria off the imports a priority. Dilapo Oni, head of energy research at Ecobank, says this attack is a setback to that effort.
It brings to the fore the fact that we haven't resolved a major issue with the refinery segment in Nigeria, which is protecting the network of pipelines that supply them crude oil.
Nigeria is Africa's largest producer of oil, but much of the income from that industry is lost to corruption. About two-thirds of Nigerians live in poverty, and the communities in the oil-producing Niger Delta are no different. An insurgency by militants fighting for more development rocked the region until the government started paying them off in exchange for peace in 2009. Tom Polo was a major player in that insurgency. The accusations against him come amid a new push against corruption by Buhari's administration. But some in the Niger Delta worry the pipeline attacks are a warning to the government. Come after Tom Polo and you'll pay. Atuyebi Oyebi is a journalist in the town of Ugeli.
If the government does not tame Tom Polo in time, Tom Polo will become a law. And when a man is a law, the state is in trouble.
Nigeria is already struggling with the global drop in oil prices. The pipeline shutdown is yet another blow to the economy. The NNPC says it is losing over $2.3 million from the shutdown daily. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. One of the big events this year will be the 2016 Rio Olympics. In one of the events, South Africa, Nigeria, and Algeria will represent Africa at the Men's Olympic Football Tournament. Now let's take a look at how the three got there and what their prospects are. VOA's Sunny Young spoke with our African football guru, David Legg.
Right, Sunny, we take it up from the semi-final stage. Nigeria upsetting Senegal 1-0, Etebo scoring from a 77-minute penalty. And then Algeria far too good for South Africa, winning 2-0. Darfalou early in the first half and Ben Kamasa early in the second half scoring the goals. Now, those victories, Sonny, assured Nigeria and Algeria of places in the final. And then we had this unusual situation. We had the third-place match followed by the final. And, in fact, it was the third-place match that was of crucial importance. That was South Africa against Senegal. And that would decide the third and final place for the Rio Games. An amazing match. If it was boxing, Sonny, Senegal would have won hands down. They had 25 shots at goal, but significantly only 6 on target. Mm. South Africa had 10 shots at goal, 6 on target. But finally, after 74 minutes, it seemed as if the incessant Senegalese pressure was going to pay off when they were awarded a penalty. But a brilliant save from Jody February saved South Africa. And then as the ball ran loose inside the goal mouth, in rushed Keita, and I thought, this is it. Senegal are going to score off the rebound. But the woodwork came to the rescue of the South Africans. And there and then, Sonny, I thought to myself, the South Africans took Lady Luck to dinner the previous evening. And they must have, they impressed her, because that was really a double big, big let-off. I think, Sonny, that raised the spirits immeasurably of the South Africans, and significantly, I think it lowered those of the Senegalese. The match finished 0-0 after 90 minutes, no extra time, which I think the South Africans would have been very appreciative of, because as we've said on all our reports about this tournament in Senegal, it was mid-afternoon and the sun was beating down, close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And that clearly gave the Senegalese an edge, but unlike the first meeting between these two countries, which finished 3-1 to Senegal, South Africans showed a lot more passion, a lot more fight. So we went to a penalty shootout, and Jody February, 19 years of age, he plays for Ajax Cape Town, he became the hero of the afternoon. He saved not one, not two, but 3 of the shootout spot kicks taken by the Senegalese. The South Africans, much more accurate, they scored 3 of their 5, so they won 3-1 on the penalty shootout. Afterwards, the Senegalese coach was crestfallen, understandably. I didn't quite agree with him when he said that his team were the best in the tournament. I think the Nigerians were actually the best. And they proved that in many senses by winning the final against Algeria by 2-1. Fascinating match. You had the flair of the Nigerians against the organization of the Algerians. And if February was the star of the South African victory, then Etebo from Wari Wolves was the toast of Nigeria. He finished, Sonny, as the leading goal scorer with 5, including both in the final. The first, he converted a penalty, and then a brilliant solo run from the center circle 5 minutes before halftime, slotted the ball past Sally like a seasoned veteran, and that gave the Nigerian Dream Team 6, as they're known, a 2-1 victory. I'm impressed, Sonny, with the flair of the Nigerians, and I think there's room there for improvement. And I think Samson Sia, the coach, will get it. I'm very impressed, too, by the Algerian organization. I think they will also do well at Rio. I think South Africa have a lot of room for improvement. They rolled their luck against Senegal. They are fighters every time, as a coach Owen de Gama pointed out. They played badly. They did bounce back. After losing to Senegal on day one, they did bounce back to beat Zambia and then Tunisia. And after that pretty good hiding from the Algerians, they did come back strongly against the Senegalese in the third-place playoff. But certainly, Sonny, you've got to stick a room for improvement tag on that South African team. And just to confirm again, the Olympics will be played in August 2016. And an important change for the finals, whereas the qualifying matches in all the regions of the world are restricted to under-23 footballers, at the finals, you're allowed what they call 3 wild cards. Now, those wild cards are players of any age. So, in other words, I think we've used this on your show before, Sonny. If it's Argentina, they can use Lionel Messi. If it's Portugal, they can use Cristiano Ronaldo. You are free to use 3 overage players. And it does trigger an interesting debate, because some coaches will use that rule and will bring in 3 senior stars. But other coaches are of the view that, hold on a minute, these under-23 players got us to Rio in the first place. I'm going to keep faith with them, and I will stick to the under-23 footballers.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In terms of the 3 African teams that qualified for the Rio Games men's football tournament, Nigeria has the proudest Olympic pedigree. The Nigerians won gold at Atlanta 1996 and a silver at Beijing 2008. Algeria and South Africa have each made only one previous Olympic appearance. The Algerians reached the quarterfinals at the 1980 Moscow Olympics, and the South Africans did not get out of the group stage at the 2000 Sydney Olympics.
Thanks, Sunny. The Rio Olympic Games 2016 begin on Friday, August 5th, and end on Sunday, August 21st. Peter?
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport Nightline, Africa Sports.
This God is beautiful. She's beautiful.
Well, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Hold your hand, chameleon, in a melody we call out.
explode. She a move like a time bomb. Ready for explode. She dey move like a time bomb. She wanna explode. Shorty move like a time bomb. Ready for explode. Time bomb. Time bomb. Time bomb. She wanna explosion. Time bomb. Time bomb. Time bomb. Two man don't come around. I want pretty ladies all around me. That sexy girl with a bad physique. I've never seen a girl like you. 10 to 1, that's the countdown. She's about to explode and cancer fusion. My girl, she's bad, she's number one. I've never seen a girl like you. That girl,
I tell you she be time bomb. Boom. Don't stop boogie, baby, wine on. Hey, your body they define her. This guy ain't boogie, no be minor.
No, no.
This body be designer. Some girl fine, but you finer. Continue to wind up, cause we never seen a girl like you.
Yeah, they go wine.
Time bomb.
A body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time bomb.
She make me lose control.
Explosion.
She sexy but sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby go low. I just wanna love you. Share with me your problems. Girl, you are the type of girl a bad man need. I just wanna love you. Share with me your problems. Girl, you are the type of girl a bad man feel. Lean on me. My girl, you are the only one for me. You're the only thing I see. Lean on me. I are the only.
Overload, type of bumper with black road. Just the sight of bumper make you feel so good. My soul food, me some of a journey walk after. Gas, gas, mogu. I make serious, I know they joke. You make man confused, I know fi cope. The machine above me to a mean some of a new. Hey, no between us.
No.
I go direct, make she see, say I mean I'm. Some romantic arena. I wanna take her to a place where the past is
green.
Time
a body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time
she
bomb.
Make me lose control.
Explosion.
Bring sexy back, sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby go low.
Explosion.
Now I let her wine.
Time bomb.
My body fire.
Time bomb.
She my desire.
Time
she
bomb.
Make me lose control.
Explosion.
Bring sexy back, sexy Nina.
Time bomb.
She came with a friend called Sabrina.
Time bomb.
Don't stop sister Nina.
Time bomb.
Baby go low.
I be your number one fan, and I dig by do your show. The things where you did display makes me wanna spend my dough. When you take it fast, when you take it slow. Baby, you're the baddest, and I hope you know. I know you're upcoming, and I know you blow. Can't you see in the dark you glow? Make you no change, cause I love you so. Can't nobody do me better, 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 better than you. Can't nobody love me better, 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 better than you. This one no be joke, oh. You didn't make me call, oh, yeah. Whether fast or slow mo, shawty, let me see you. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Take it down low, rock, rock this body. Let them know that you don't send nobody. Now you, I can't see. I want you to take good care. Directions, me I did like your ways. Now your body and your perfection, now you did make me crazy. Cause I'm loving the things that you wear.
you got a good taste. There's nowhere else I'd rather be than at your place, yeah. Can't nobody do me better, 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 better than you. Can't nobody love me better, better, roll it.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group affiliated with Al-Qaeda, has struck again. This time, however, it has avoided its usual soft civilian targets and attacked an Amazon military base in the south close to the Kenyan border. There are two versions of what transpired. Al-Qaeda announced that it had attacked a Kenyan military base, killed a minimum of 60 Kenyan soldiers, and taken over the base camp. The Kenyan military version is different. It stated that Al-Qaeda attacked a Somali military camp near a Kenyan camp, and that the Kenyan had intervened to support the Somalis, and in the process lost about 40 Kenyan soldiers. Some of these soldiers were paraded in the town. The peacekeeping force, Amazon, supported by the United Nations, has not yet given its own assessment of the situation. But this event marks another example of the inability to learn the lesson of terrorism. Terrorism, whether regional or international, is a global affair, and it is essential that one looks for a global solution. Just imagine what happened last Friday evening after the attack in Somalia, when terrorist group in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, entered an hotel, took hostages, and in a rescue operation at the end, 13 casualties were announced. Or even go back to December in Bamako, Mali, when a similar terrorist action occurred. Not to mention the daily terrorist casualties in Nigeria and neighboring countries. No one can doubt the efforts of the governments in this area to deal with Boko Haram. But it is not an easy matter to detect at all occasions a child with a suicide vest walking into a marketplace or in a bus stop and detonating their vest. It's very difficult. What you have is that when you have terrorist acts, politicians tend to minimize the difficulties and make an assumption that it is possible to deal with these terrorist acts. Yes, intelligence can try its best, military forces can do it, but you cannot, under present circumstances, detect all terrorist acts. For example, the attack in Somalia is very similar to an attack perpetrated by the Taliban terrorist group in Afghanistan just a few weeks ago, when trucks were packed full of explosives and then they were blown up when they tried to breach the base camp. So this is something which the world community should bring their attention to. The Secretary General of the United Nations just a few weeks ago made a pertinent statement that it is necessary to look at the underlying causes for terrorist activities. This is very similar to a resolution by the General Assembly at the time of the Munich Olympic crisis when Israeli athletes were murdered. This is why it is difficult to understand why in Somalia not much effort is being made to see whether there can be an accommodation with Al-Shabaab. It will not be easy, but the effort should be made. Why are not efforts being made to reach a better political solution in Somalia? It is not enough that Al-Shabaab has been moved out of all major cities and towns. Still, they're able to punish and perpetrate terrorist acts in Somalia. In Syria, where we have also daily terrorist acts, efforts are being made to bring all the parties together to minimize terrorist acts and to confront the terrorist group of the Islamic State. So this is something which the United Nations, the African Union, should do in Somalia. Even in Nigeria, President Buhari had said that he is prepared to meet competent and serious partners in Boko Haram to find a political accommodation. Terrorism cannot be fought only by military means. There is a need to also search for political solution to deal with this global menace. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Jackson Invonganyi, and our engineer for today, Martin Cassius, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, you don't dance if you carry a basket full of eggs. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.